Hey, filmmakers, Shane Hurlbut here, ASC cinematographer and co-founder of Filmmakers Academy. You know, when I started out, I had to learn it all the hard way. There was no roadmap, no mentor, just a trial by fire. And that's why I built Filmmakers Academy, to give you the tools I wish I had coming up. We're talking about a shortcut here. We drop new content multiple times a month, connect filmmakers around the world, and coach you through every step of your journey. And hey, right now you can get $50 off your first year of annual membership with code FAPOD50. So come join us. Let's build your career together.
Welcome to a brand new season of Finding the Frame. I'm delighted that for the first show back, I get to welcome someone whose work I've been following since 2012 and their film Looper. It's a cinematographer who's forged a formidable partnership with director Rian Johnson over 30 years with films such as Brick and Knives Out and The Last Jedi and Glass Onion and now the third Benoit Blanc mystery, Wake Up Dead Man. It is my profound honor to welcome Steve Yedlin, ASC. Steve, welcome to Finding the Frame. So first of all, Steve, let's dive into your background. I'm really intrigued as to how you started in cinematography. What drew you to cinematography first? I believe you were a gaffer at one point doing low-budget films. So what drew you into cinematography?
Right. Yeah. Well, I mean, even by the time I was doing that, I already wanted to be a cinematographer. I think, when I was in middle school is kind of when I first got interested, not just in liking movies, but hey, how do these get made? Who actually makes them? What's the process of it? And, I remember the thing that really got me excited about that was the visual effects in Back to the Future 2. I was just like, what is this? Who does this? How does this stuff come into existence? And, I'd already been excited about movies. Like, I was a huge Star Wars fan when I was a kid, but that's kind of when it switched to not just liking the movie, but how do these things get made and getting curious about it. And that's kind of when I just started making homemade movies and bothered my parents to buy me a video camera and stuff. And, but I still had no real concept of division of labor. The end crawl, the end credits of a movie were just gibberish to me. I didn't know what any of that meant. And, I started in high school. I started volunteering on student films, just going there and driving out to USC student films and working on those. And, even though they're student films and they're not a full production, they still have departments. Like, there's a camera department and a production, production designer and, art department and, a little bit of that division of labor. And at the time I was kind of, once I saw that, I was like, ooh, I was drawn to the camera, and that side of things. And it's sort of lucky. I think that that really was a good choice for me, because I think at the time I was more interested in just that the camera looked like a cool thing, which would never have sustained my interest. And now, and now I'm a lot more interested in the actual visual storytelling. And, I am still really glad that was the department I was drawn to, but for a very different reason now.
I know you've talked about like your visual influences in terms of Back to the Future 2 and the VFX and stuff like that. Were there any sort of cinematographers that you were looking at whose work you really admired at that time, or was it more down the VFX side?
Not yet. Not when I was very first understanding, what the departments even were. I still didn't really have a concept of. I still didn't have a solid concept of what the artistry was of the different crafts, but very quickly after that I did. Within a year or two, and it was, pretty early on, it was I mean, a bunch of things, but especially, you know, Roger Deakins' work with the Coen brothers.
Yeah.
And, you know, and you know, especially Barton Fink and, you know, also, you know, and also the pre Deakins Coen brothers stuff, the Barry Sonnenfeld.
Oh, yeah. Oh, very cool. Yeah. Would you say that, like, in terms of, I know that you've said in the past you're obsessed with the art and science of motion imaging and photographic lighting and things like that. Would you say that, like, being working through the gaffing and then going through the lighting department and things like that, would you say that that was what instilled in you that passion for it? You were seeing these different technical advances that were going on?
No, I think I was already excited about it before that. That was a little bit of a, you know, and I was never a gaffer on anything other than like tiny, tiny stuff. To go back to that sort of first time I ever volunteered on a student film, you know, even before I started to, you know, appreciate the artistry of all these great cinematographers and knowing their names and, you know, understanding the difference in the styles, you know, I do remember the very first time I ever, because today we all have like phones that have cameras and we're so used to you shoot something, you're seeing it right when you're shooting it. And, you know, at the time everything was, you know, shot on film and, I had a video camera at home, but I'm going to this student film and I'm watching it shot on film and I'm watching the film go through the camera and all that. Yeah. And then they invited me to their dailies, which because it was a, student film was actually a class, you know, with the other students and stuff. And, you know, I just remember thinking, oh my God, and this was just 16 millimeter film process and printed. They hadn't sat down and color graded it or anything. And just thinking, wow, it looks better than reality. Cause this is the first time I was there when they shot it. Yeah. Now I'm seeing it completely photographically rendered. And I'm like, wow, it looks more beautiful than, you know, I was there. I saw what it really looked like. And, right. You know, that's something, although a lot of what got me interested at that time is now totally not why I'm interested in it. That's one thing that kind of has survived because, you know, I love that sort of artful color rendering and where, you know, it's not, you know, and it's something that I've not just made use of, but something that I've even sort of studied and developed my own tools for, which is how do we get this color and tonal rendering that's not it's not colorimetrically or photometrically accurate, but it's just beautiful, you know.
Yeah, I mean, it's something you've done a lot of videos. I'm going to get into that a bit later on in a few actually, but there's a lot of videos. If you go on your website, you've got one that's debugging HDR, which is fantastic. It's about 2 hours long. Definitely worth a watch.
Oh boy, I don't know about that.
It's interesting though, Steve, because it's one of those things where I don't come from a cinematography background. I've obviously worked for Shane Hill, but at the website that we work on and stuff like that. So I've done lots of different things like that and he's super technical and things like that. But it's something that, you know, when you're trying to learn about the rendering process and going through the process, that, you know, the post-production and how color is added to the image and stuff like that, it's something that if you watch something like that, you really do break it down and make it simple, you know, simplify it for us and talk
it out. Thank you.
You know, so I'm grateful to that. And it's something, as I said, I'm going to get on later in this interview. Once we've set up everything like that. But yeah, definitely one of those videos to watch, guys, if you're interested. It's certainly one of those. And there's a few other ones as well. I think it was Film 35 versus Arri Alexa video as well.
Yeah.
Cool one to watch.
Yeah, that one, it's sort of superficially film versus digital, but it's really more fundamental than that. It's and that one's much more accessible. It's only 7 minutes long. And while it is a niche thing, it's not as totally niche and technical as the 2 hour crazy deep dive on HDR. But you know, that one's, you know, really about understanding the leverage point in our tools, because there's a lot of stuff that gets almost superstitiously attributed to the camera brand that's actually where those attributes actually come from the processing, that, you know, not what device is capturing the information, but what we do with the information. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this sort of superficial film versus digital thing, which is pretty exhausting to me. But, you know, it's really only an example of that, because there's also the other superstitions, like even digital to digital, where people will say like, oh, this camera brand's getting better skin tones or something. Like, it's not really the camera brand, though. It's what you're doing with the information that the camera gets. It's not, you know, it's not the camera. So it's kind of, you know, the idea of it is to, empower filmmakers to be able to use the real leverage points of what they can do with this stuff, rather than sort of being stuck in the superstition that you know, kind of falsely creates this brand allegiance based on a misconception.
Is that something that you've been working on, and it's something that you're sort of, I'm getting out of the interview now just talking about this stuff, because it is fascinating. Is that something that you're working on in terms of developing technology which can, you know, maximize the image, I suppose, is the best way I can put it, you know, once it comes out of the camera?
The thing is, I sort of don't want to be another, I want to empower people to do their own thing. I sort of actively don't want to be like, okay, they're going to take their superstition off of the camera brand and now put it on me, and I'm magic thing, you know, because that's just doing the same thing again. Because the whole point is, that you don't have to be, you know, you can be an author rather than a shopper of, you know, how the, you know, this is the last little bit of finesse on the image, right? I mean, the real cinematography and the way the image looks like it is the lighting and the shot design, and you know, that's the real visual authorship, and this stuff is important, but it is like that last little finesse layer. But for that last finesse layer, which does matter, you know, this is, you know, I'm advocating for people to be authors instead of shoppers. So I don't want to just be another like off the shelf brand that they shop for. That being said, I also understand that not everybody's going to do the insane deep dive, the crazy tech stuff that I do. They're not going to necessarily write code and do all the data sets and write the math and all that. So, you know, I understand that people still are looking for some kind of a solution other than me saying that it's possible to do stuff. I've partnered with, a colleague and friend, Colin Kelly, who has a Resolve plugin that's got all of his own color transformations in it, not my stuff, but then he licensed my like grain inhalation to put in there. So that is out there, for example.
I saw that when we do, was it Poker Face? It's got that kind of beautiful filmy look. You know what I mean? And it was one of those questions I was going to ask you. Actually, I didn't answer my questions, but, you know, It looks filmier than film. I think somebody quoted as saying, you know what I mean? Right. Was it one of those things where you were thinking, I'm going to shoot this on digital and make it look more sort of 1970s sort of filmy look? Or what was that something you were planning from the beginning? Or is that something?
I mean, yes, we knew we were going to use the film emulation stuff. Mm-hmm. But the thing is, we didn't really do anything in the film emulation itself that's specifically 1970s. I mean, our references and our inspiration was, you know, the original Columbo and, you know, some other things of that time. But we weren't, you know, but it was just how would we do something like that now? It wasn't, so even to the extent that we have film emulation, it's not 1970s film emulation. It's just contemporary film emulation, really. And I think some of the 1970s feel of it is the combo of, you know, what we're doing with the lighting and the, you know, just that the show itself actually feels like something that could have been in the 70s, just the style of the show. You know, even the script and the fact that it's not, you know, the fact that the episodes are standalone and not, you know, because contemporary shows tend to be this ongoing long story, whereas the 1970s shows are somewhat of a reset. I mean, it also has a through line Poker Face, but there's like that little thread that goes throughout, but overall each one's individual. And then, you know, also just the titles, you know, just the titles looking
very cool.
Very classic, 1970s, you know? So I think it's a whole lot of things that come, that, that, work together to create that that impression rather than some one specific trick.
There will be those who will ask the question, you know, if you're going to try and make something look like it's shot on film, why not just shoot it on film? And I'm going to posit that to you, even though I can kind of come up with reasons myself, but
yeah. People do have asked that many times and even phrased exactly that way. And the answer is that the word just there is doing a lot of heavy lifting because the thing is that there's a little bit of a confusion between a developer and a user, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you know, like a software developer is not the same thing as a user. So it's a little bit like saying to somebody who, you know, designs the iPhone, saying, why don't you just use Android?
Yeah.
You know, because they're, you know, developing something versus using something are two different things.
Yeah.
And, you know, the what has gone into, you know, what has gone into film being developed and coming into existence is thousands upon thousands of scientists, engineers, really smart people at labs, at Kodak, at Fuji, over 100 years. Mm-hmm. And not only that, but for even to work today, you still need some people working on your own movie, not just resting on the laurels of what people have done in the past, to set up a color pipeline that works. Mm-hmm. Now, the director doesn't have to do that, but somebody does.
Yeah.
You know, and the thing is, there's no less or more of that has to happen with digital. When we're actually shooting, it's actually less stuff that's going on to figure out the pipeline. So if you're not the person that does it, so if you're the director, or if you're a more hands-off DP as opposed to a hands-on DP like me, you're not the one doing it. So there's no just. Because you're not doing it anyway, somebody else is, you know, and on my particular projects, you know, I'm either completely doing it myself or largely doing it myself with help from other people. And I can tell you that in terms of the just, it's a lot less work to get exactly the look we want from digital as opposed to film, because, you know, firstly, that's what I've been putting all of the effort into, where I already have stuff set up to where when I start a new project, there's less, you know, I want to spend the prep on that project, prepping that movie, right? Like in the past, when things were only photochemical and film, you wouldn't spend the prep of your movie inventing a print stock. Kodak does that, not the cinematographer. When you're prepping the movie, you have to prep the movie. Like, what lights are we going to have on this day and all that. So you don't want to be inventing things from scratch. And you know, because of specific projects and over the years, I have all this stuff that I've already developed. When I go on to a new project, there's very little for me to do to get exactly that color and tonal rendering that I'm after with digital. Whereas with film, the film doesn't make it, especially now. In the past, when it was contact printed, there was sort of this locked system that felt like the film had a specific look, but nobody does that. I mean, literally nobody. You know, the one person, Chris Nolan, who has a few prints like that, does a few prints. Like, that's still, everybody else is seeing scanned neg.
Yeah.
So, you know, negative already doesn't have the magic look. Negative, film negative that goes in the camera is orange and flat and backwards. It's not the look of your movie. You need something to translate it. And in the past, that was a print stock with contact printing. But now, as soon as it gets scanned, you not only, you know, with digital, you start with an uninterpreted camera original, and then you put it through some sort of process to get the photographic look. It could be the off-the-shelf one from the manufacturer, or it could be mine, or it could be that one that I mentioned that Cullen's got. But you need something that takes the uninterpreted data and prepares it for a look. And, you know, with film, that used to be the contact printing. Now you scan it, and rather than that preparing it for a look, it's now doubly out of control because you have one uninterpreted thing, the camera negative, being photographed by another uninterpreted thing, the scanner. And now you have to prepare that with a photographic look. So you've got multiple things that are out of control, and it's actually more effort to prep it to look correct. So, you know, for example, You know, on Last Jedi, we have both film and digital all throughout the movie.
And you create a look to make them all look the same, right?
Exactly. And the thing is, and that one is the, that one's a great example of why it's not the word just, because the one of those two that I did all the work for, that I did spend time in prep, was for the film to look right, because I already had all the stuff for the digital, but for the film to look right, we had to lock down the scanner so that it wasn't changing scan settings roll to roll. You know, we had to build a, you know, we had to replace the internal, you know, because the scanner's got a LUT that that's, that goes from the sensor linear to the film log, and we had to change the scanner's LUT. Then we had to build the, you know, the show LUT for the digital that we wouldn't, that we already had for the film. You know, so we had to do all of that work, you know. And
why did you go through that whole thing, why did you not just shoot it all on, not just, forgive me saying the word, just, all right, why didn't you shoot it on one camera and keep it at one camera? Why did you change it out to a different
I would have if it was just up to me, but there was a lot of going on in terms of, you know, everything from the franchise legacy to what the visual effects people wanted, what Ryan wanted. There was a lot of stuff that I knew.
A lot of masters.
Yeah. So I was like, well, you know, if we need to, yeah, if we need to check all these boxes, that's fine, because I know how to, because the whole point that I'm making here is the camera is not the leverage point. But if people sort of don't believe that or whatever, and I have to deal with it, I know that it's not the leverage point. So I was able to get the look I wanted from the different cameras, and it didn't matter to me other than the fact that, you know, if they want me, you know, they're, you know, whatever, they're the ones paying for my time. If they want me to develop stuff that we don't necessarily need to develop, because that's, you know, because that's what we're doing, that's, you know, that's fine. And that's what we did. And it, you know, it turned out great. And that's, you know, as far as I'm concerned, like, we got what we want out of it, what we wanted out of it. And, the camera wasn't the leverage point. The color pipeline was. And just another funny example of the why don't you just, misconception is the display prep demo itself, which is the name of that little 7-minute movie that I made about film versus digital. Both of the images came out interchangeable, not identical, but interchangeable, to where an next to each other, they may not look exactly the same, but if an audience is only going to see one or the other, they can't tell the difference.
Correct.
And, but the film one, had scratches that we had to paint out. We actually had scratches on the film, on one of the rolls. So there were a couple shots where we had to paint scratches out. So when you say the word just, it was a lot more effort. There was a lot more just going on with the digital than with the film.
I will say, by the way, Last Jedi is the most beautiful looking Star Wars film, I think. As a Star Wars fan. Well. So guys, I've got Banta next to him right here. definitely.
Oh my God.
I worked on something with Jon Favreau that was for down in Disney. Just as part of the art department, and I'll be honest, getting to work amongst all the ships and put together like an M1 speeder and stuff was like all my boyhood dreams come true. So I can only imagine, you know, somebody like yourself who loved VFX when he was younger, to then work on a Star Wars film, and arguably, as I said, the best looking Star Wars film is.
It was insane. I mean, I loved Star Wars so much when I was a kid, and I think I didn't even like sort of realize it, or my brain didn't unlock until recently, like fully well into adulthood, that I think one of the main reasons I got into cinema was actually John Williams. You know, like, I think about how magical that Star Wars music was to me, you know, and also, you know, Superman and you know, Raiders of the Lost Ark. Like, I think even though I didn't understand it at the time, in hindsight, I think that the John Williams may be the single biggest factor in my love of cinema.
I'd agree wholeheartedly. I could listen to his soundtracks back and forth, you know, and they've just named the Hollywood Bowl stage after him, actually. So, a thing just recently. 96 years old. I mean, he's still cracking on. I think he's doing the new Spielberg movie, actually. I think he's...
Oh, yeah, yeah. I saw that. That's exciting.
Flying Saucer, whatever it's called, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, Steve, talk me through, like, we'll go back now a little bit, but I was fascinated to learn about all the digital process that you were talking through them. But, you know, 30 years working with Ryan Johnson, you formed this amazing partnership. I mean, it's one of the most longest running director DP relationships in contemporary cinema. I think you'd find 9 feature films you've done. And talk me through how you two came to know each other. You were working in high school, you were working on student films, I believe, and he was at UC. Yes. So talk me through how you came to know each other, what you saw in each other as artists at that early stage, and when you became his DP, I suppose, and he became your director, and you ended up working together.
Yeah. So when I met him when I was a senior in high school and he was a freshman in college, and it was on, it is on one of the student film sets that I was volunteering on, and he was doing the same. He was already at USC, but he was in general ed and hadn't started the film program yet. Mm-hmm. And, so he was doing the same thing, just volunteering on student film. And, yeah, we kind of saw each other, and there's like sort of a bunch of stories in there, but the main one of just us getting to know each other part was, we had, you know, those things shoot on the weekends since they're student films because they're going to classes during the week. So, you know, we saw each other over these several weekends, but we kind of never really got to know each other. And then suddenly we sort of did at some point. And we kind of said, hey, let's stay in touch. And we ended up meeting back up and showing each other our films that we had made. And I would not have shown him my stupid film if he had shown me his first, because I realized how embarrassingly, I mean, you know, I was a kid and it was very much a movie that a kid made, whereas his was like, oh my God, this is like a real movie. And then we made a little short film together that summer on 16mm. We drove up from Los Angeles to San Francisco and shot it in a weekend. And it's just a little chase scene called Hey Lady, You Dropped Your Wallet, which I think you can find on the internet. And it's also a Easter egg extra on one of the Blu-rays and DVDs. It's either Brothers Bloom or Looper, I'm not sure.
Oh, that's so cool.
Which
I'll link to it.
and then all through film school we would just we did make an actual official student film together, like the intermediate project that you have to do, which at the time was like a 7 or 8 minute black and white 16mm film that you had to do. Mm-hmm. And we did that together for the program, but we also would just, you know, the bigger thing is we would just kind of make these disposable movies just for fun to hone the craft, like on the weekends. So me and Ryan and some of the other people in the cinema dorm that we lived in, you know, sometimes on a Friday night, I'd say, hey, do you want to shoot something this weekend? And we'd kind of shoot it and edit it. And, you know, by Sunday night, we would have our lame version of it's been edited and sound mixed and we have a thing. But they were just these kind of disposable things where we're like just making movies to practice and to make movies. And yeah, so we've been doing it since then. And, you know, I loved Ryan's stuff so much. In my mind, I was kind of like, I would just be lucky to get to work with Ryan no matter what he does, whether it's big or small in my life. And then somehow I got lucky enough that he keeps bringing me along for some reason. So,
I mean, he seems fascinating. How would you say that your creative shorthand as a DP and director has evolved over time? Obviously, from those early days, what was it? Hey, lady, you drop your wallet, thesaurus thief, and all that kind of stuff. And how you've developed over time? How would you say that creative shorthand's developed?
Yeah, there hasn't been any sort of large break point, I don't think. It's, you know, it always feels like just, you know, working with Ryan always feels like that comfort of family, but there's certainly been an evolution of just sort of things getting, you know, better and better. I mean, Ryan was always brilliant at shot design and he's gotten only better at it. And, you know, his confidence too of, you know, he's really a master at, he really knows cinema. He really knows the cinema language. He really knows he's really confident in what he wants, but he's also really confident at sort of, this is where what I want as a director ends at this level of specificity. Mm-hmm. And then beyond that, he doesn't micromanage me at all. He trusts me to make that a reality sort of the best way possible. You know, he's not like showing me references saying it better look like this or something, you know, I mean, it's just, you know, he'll have these sort of, you know, big specific ideas, and it's up to me to make them a reality. And that goes from, you know, things, you know, all the way back to Brick, like in Brick, there's the pin character has this basement lair.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, it's got a really low ceiling, and Ryan wanted this kind of, when Brendan's standing in the middle, he wanted this like kind of ugly fluorescent light right over him, and he wanted these lights next to the pin on the walls so that it's kind of bright in his face. Yeah. So he, you know, he knew, you know, exactly sort of the idea of what he wants, but he's also so and then he communicates that to me on a conceptual level, and then, you know, and then I execute it. And he lets me do it, which is just beautiful, because I know that, you know, luckily I haven't personally dealt with this too much, but I know it's like out in the world, there's relationships where it's kind of the opposite, where on the one hand, the director doesn't have a clear idea, but yeah. of their own part, but then they're micromanaging the DP on their part,
yeah.
you know, and so this is kind of perfect. So all the way from Brick to, you know, like Wake Up Dead Man is the kind of the same thing, but on a much bigger scale, where he has all the very specific stuff. Like, you know, in Wake Up Dead Man, we have all these light changes where, like, within the church and also the rectory and stuff, where, you know, you feel within the scene that the cloud goes in front of the sun, and then mm-hmm. the sun comes out back out of the clouds, you know, and you have really specific stuff that he wanted. Here, there's one scene where the big God rays come out, or there's another scene yeah. where, you know, as Judd's giving the swelling speech about faith, that the sun is, you know, coming up out of the clouds behind him and flares the lens. And, you know, that's kind of the same thing where Ryan's got the concept. He's very confident about it. There's no sort of indecision negotiation. Yeah. You know, he knows exactly that he wants that, but he's also not micromanaging me or you know, he doesn't go beyond his part of the specificity and kind of lets me and the crew and everybody kind of figure out how to do that the best way possible without any kind of sort of logistical shackles.
I get that. Do you think that's the value with staying loyal to like a one director? I know that you've done lots of other the music videos, you've done lots of hands and things like that, but like staying loyal to that director for features, and like I'm thinking, like, you know, you've got like Linus Sandgren's working with Emerald Fennell and Noah Baumbach, and I think Denis Villeneuve this year, so he's worked with lots of different directors and presumably has to change it some ways process to suit that director and the way they work. Do you think that there's a lot more value in your relationship with Ryan and the fact that it's developed over, you know, 3 decades?
Yeah, I mean, well, yes, but I'm also, I mean, I'm just also purely lucky that he keeps bringing me along, and he's the absolute best at this stuff. But I really enjoy the other styles too. Like the last two non-Ryan, you know, obviously I do fewer non-Ryan movies now than I used to just because of schedule. But you know, I do fewer in between his movies. But like the last two that I did were both with, you know, directors that I loved, and it's a very different working style. But that's fine. Like I like doing different working styles. Yeah. You know, it's you know, to me, yeah, and to me, like I don't mind what it is. It's like fun to do it differently and to adapt to somebody's style. To me, the only thing I wouldn't want is that sort of incommensurate thing I was talking about, where if somebody doesn't have an idea but then is also micromanaging you, you know, like whatever level of specificity they want to go up to, no matter how vague or specific, whatever it is, they know what they want up to their part, and then they let me do my part, and, you know, mutual respect, and you know, like any version of that, I'm great with. I love all of it.
So tell me through your process then, having said that, you know, like from the moment you get approached with a script, let's say it's Ryan Johnson or somebody comes to you with a script, what do you do? How do you approach how you do your job? Are you somebody who reads the script multiple times, makes notes on it as to how you think that the camera might move, etc.? Just talk me through it. Talk through your processes.
I mean, it is really different with different directors, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, specifically with Ryan, the thing that's different than most other directors that I've worked with, and, you know, as you said, I've probably worked with fewer other directors than, because I've been busy with Ryan. But you know, the level to which he already knows and is confident about what he wants, means that, you know, I get a lot more prep to actually make that the best reality possible. You know, because the fact that somebody does something a different way doesn't mean that the prep schedule is longer. You know, so if it's more of a way, you know, and I totally enjoy this too, but if it's more of a way where, like, I'm sitting down with the director and we're, you know, figuring out shots together and all that, that's super fun. And I love it, but it just also means we're not really as clearly decided as soon. So there's going to be some things that we didn't really have the, as much of a clear idea about until, you know, even if we started it 6 weeks out, we don't know this particular thing until 1 week out, mm-hmm. or something. So that particular scene is not going to have, you know, necessarily, and we'll try to do it, obviously we'll try to do it where scenes that are easier to logistically implement, you plan those ones last so that you do, you know, the ones that are more complicated, you've figured out earlier, but there still is a little bit of a level of, like how fun and enjoyable it is equal, but sort of how the prep time gets used isn't exactly equal, you know?
I get you. So then let's bring it to the Benoit Blanc trilogy, I suppose. Mm-hmm. You know, this is your third one. So like, how are you massaging those three distinct visual styles? Are you looking for something that's got visual continuity throughout the three? Or are you trying to sort of give each one a different identity, I suppose? You know, like, that's one of my questions. You know, I know you've got, like, Knives Out, you've got this sort of autumnal, woody, sort of New England mansion kind of mystery, and then Glass Onions in the Mediterranean, it's all Sundays, and then this super modern sort of building with the Mona Lisa in it. And then finally, Wake Up Dead Man takes us into this sort of gothic church, you know. So talk me through it. What would you say?
Yeah. No, I mean, absolutely. I mean, obviously, Wake Up Dead Man is a lot, got that gothic and, you know, deeply contrasty look to a lot of it. But, you know, the thing is, like, the way Ryan and I approach it is, we're really just trying to tell the story the best visual way possible, like the most, you know, the most powerful visuals that theatrically bring to life this particular story. So on the one hand, we don't want it to be boring. You know, we want it to be really rich and evocative.
So it wasn't boring.
You know, but on the other hand, we're not trying to, we're not trying to show off with it. The all that stuff is there to underscore and heighten the story. And it's, you know, it's hard enough to figure out how to do that without sort of putting artificial rules on yourself. Like, it has to be the same as the other movie, or it has to be different than the other movie. Yeah. And so really, you know, and also Ryan is very deliberate that he doesn't want to repeat himself or rest on his laurels. These are different movies than each other. They're not even really sequels, because it's just like Agatha Christie, where it's just another Hercule Poirot book, and you can read them in different orders. You know, and so he really, you know, he doesn't want to repeat himself. He wants to push things to the next level each time. So it's, you know, hard enough to figure out how to do that without putting rules on yourself. So I think that the you know, using the same principles, like we're using the same working style, we're obviously going to automatically have even with the same working style, we're going to have a totally different look if we're successful at supporting the story, because this is a totally different story. Mm-hmm. This is a much more gothic story that even has horror type elements, like with the crypt scene and with the flashback scene and stuff. So if we actually work to support this story, it's automatically going to have a very different look than the other movies. But then also, because it's us doing it, and it's also the similar thing with ensemble cast and a lot of times with people in the same rooms and some of the same puzzles to solve, it's also automatically going to have some aspect of it that is reminiscent of, mm-hmm. of the other movie. So it kind of feels like if we put all our effort into, we're neither trying to make it look the same nor different. We're just trying to do the best job we can on this thing. And then if you do that successfully, it just is going to look totally different because it's a totally different story that's much more gothic and all of this. And then it's also going to have some recognizable elements simply because it's got that ensemble cast and the same sort of, you know, some of the same character dynamics.
Are you looking to push boundaries or to find new challenges every new movie of these ones? Are you trying to go, oh yeah, what if we did this? Or what if we did that? Or what if we use different, like you've talked about the lighting, which we're going to get into as well, which is, you know, all these different ways that lighting changes throughout the scene and stuff, which sounds like a challenge in itself. Is that something you're looking for when you're taking on a new Benoit Blanc mystery, I suppose?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, and any movie, not just yeah. Benoit Blanc. I mean, I kind of always, you know, hope to push it to a next level if we can. And what's awesome, you know, specifically with Ryan is, you know, he wants to do that too. Mm-hmm. And so he's giving me these challenges, you know, like if it's sort of not baked into the story and the fabric of the thing at a core level, mm-hmm. If you super add it, you know, it might not be right for the movie, you know. So the fact that that's what was built into this thing was all these like really rich different lighting scenarios, all the ones that change within the scene, but then ones that change across scenes where we've got, you know, overcast, sunny, day, night, dusk, dawn, early morning, sun rays. You know, we have just all of these different things, you know, and all in all of the locations, but also you have all of those different scenarios even within just the main church set.
Mm-hmm. That church set definitely stood out to me because you had this, like, there was, I think, the scene between the two Joshes, Josh Goblin mm-hmm. and Josh O'Connor, like where one had the stained glass window over his shoulder looking down and all beautiful and colourful and everything, and it's in this sort of very grey sort of stone church, you know what I mean? So mm-hmm. every time you're cutting back and forth, you've got this kind of real kind of deep greyness, and then you've got this beautiful colour thing. I don't know, it reminded me of Network, you know, that bit in Network where he's preaching, he's got that bit behind him with those.
Oh, yeah.
I had that sort of sense in my mind when I was watching it. But, you know, so, and I think when I was actually watching it, I wrote down windows right from the very beginning, because at the beginning you've got Josh, I suppose anybody could write that about any film, but with Josh O'Connor, he's sitting, what a stupid thing to write, all these other journalists are already writing good things, but he's sitting bathed in this light, you know, almost like blowing out, I suppose, when he's sitting in front of it, and it's, you know, this is a guy who's full of faith and everything like that, so at the very beginning. And then we see it clouding as we go through and stuff like that. Was that something you were trying to do? You were using lighting as that motif?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And, you know, that set, by the way, and I told Rick Heinrichs, our production designer, this, that's my favorite set that I've ever shot in. I mean, what he did with that set, it's so beautiful and nuanced, and, you know, it's really evocative of the, you know, everything about the story. And then logistically for us, what he gave us so that we could do all those different lighting cues and different feels and all that, you know, and, you know, obviously what he did was so magnificent that, like, kind of the stuff that I worked with him and his team on, you know, it was all sort of little finesse things, you know, we weren't asking for any, I mean, he just made that magnificent thing, and that, you know, no substantial input from us. So, you know, all the mm-hmm. stuff that we were working with them on was, you know, logistical things like, how are we going to place it in the stage? Like, we need more room on this, on the side where the sun's coming in than on the other side, and things like that. And one of those things was figuring out the windows, because there was a, we want to get a sense of what's out there. Like if the whole thing had been stained glass, which was discussed at some point, you know, you wouldn't get a sense of all these different times of day, you know, and then not only that, but if you do have sun coming through or something, you could end up with really weird, ugly colors, right? Because if you have stained glass that's, if some of it's red and some of it's blue, you're going to get like an ugly purple on people, you know, or whatever. So we ended up with this amazing sort of perfect combo of huge windows that are mostly clear, but they're sort of like rippled and obscured just enough that you're not like clearly looking out. Mm-hmm. But these beautiful backings that I also want to talk more about later, outside the windows that have the all the evocative tree and sky and all that. And then you have the stained glass at the top. Also at the back of the church, the windows are full stained glass, but with the big tall ones on the side, just the top is stained glass. So you always get that color and you can have it in the shot, but it's not, but the light that's coming through isn't all going through there and making everything into a weird, you know, because when you only, when the window's not in, yeah, because when the window's not in the shot and you only see the person, you're going to see the sum of whatever that happens to be of mm-hmm. the stained glass. And it could end up being a really ugly, splotchy color, even if the stained glass is beautiful to look at it directly. It could, the sum of the different colors in it, whatever they sum up into a single color, could end up being really ugly, you know? Yeah. So we kind of had the best of all worlds where we didn't have to deal with that problem. We've got these beautiful windows that are great for lighting and for seeing the evocative stuff out the window, but they're kind of rippled just enough that, you know, the fact that we're looking at a backing and not the real world is fuddled a little. You still have the color of the stained glass. And then the windows in the back that are never a main source of illumination, those ones could be full stained glass.
And now you go on like a DMX board for when you're changing the way the light changes throughout the scene, or what was?
Yeah, so we have custom software, actually, that we're actually working on me and a partner are actually working on something that eventually is going to be a publicly available product, but right now is kind of a Frankenstein prototype.
A little bit.
So it's kind of our own software, and the way I do it, I'm a weird nerd, I'm actually doing a lot of the stuff myself rather than the lighting programmer. I mean, the lighting programmer still has a ton of work to do, but in terms of what's actually happening at the moment of finessing the lighting, you know, I've got the control of both the nuance of the light, the color, the intensity, all of that, plus the timing of the cues and everything. And I really like doing, like, I know that most people probably wouldn't want to do that because they don't want to be thinking about that. You know, they want somebody else to do it because they want to think about other things or whatever. But, you know, to me, the sort of operational part is easy enough that it doesn't take up the brain power. I can go directly to the result rather than the method of the result. So it allows me to finesse right up until the last minute, and you know, every little thing, like, you know, the exact key to fill ratio, or if we've got, you know, if the sky is steely blue compared to the warm sun, I'm finessing exactly the warm versus cool, and these kind of things. And we can do it right up, you know, till the last minute. So, you know, whereas, you know, when stuff was all physical, you know, before the LEDs and everything, obviously you wouldn't even be able to change something without, like, somebody's got to get up on a ladder and put a scrim in the light.
Yeah.
Yeah, which obviously you could be doing after you've called ready and the actors have arrived. But even beyond that, even in the normal, the more contemporary version, if it's, I have to tell the gaffer something, the gaffer tells the lighting programmer, then there's an interpretation step because, you know, we're using descriptive terms, it's not like a technical physical amount. Yeah. Then you have to see whether that result is what you thought, whereas here I can just be doing these tiny little finesse things. I can do it right up to the last minute, like, so, you know, like, even, you know, there's some times where, for example, we get it, you know, pretty, you know, we get it almost there with the stand-ins, and then I say to the AD, okay, when we get first team here, when we get the movie stars here, I just need like 15 seconds of them just on their mark, and I'm just gonna do that last little extra bit of finesse. And they say okay, and I nominally get that time, except the whole time they're like, looking away from the director or something, you know. And then I never actually get it. But then on those times, then like they do the slate, and literally right when the slate comes down, I just do that really fast, do that last little finesse bit, and you know.
Oh, that's cool. So are you doing that on like an iPad, or is like an app that you designed?
No, it's, I mean, it's, you know, it's a computer. I have a workstation on a cart that's got, you know, it's got a big, nice monitor so I can see focus really well and everything. And then it's also got a screen that's the GUI for all the light control stuff. And it also has the camera control stuff on it too, where I can change the white balance and, or the ND, the rear ND filters and stuff just from the same computer that's controlling the lights.
A couple more things in Wake Up Dead Man that especially like while we're on the subject of lighting that really kind of struck me. One of them was I love the Andrew Scott sci-fi writer house where he's got all those post-its on his windows. Yes. Yeah. I thought that was a beautiful way of creating a stained glass window with, you know, post-its, which was lovely. But the other one that I really would love you to dive into was, you know, outside Wix's mausoleum, grave, whatever you want to call it. You know, it's a rainy night, very kind of Conrad Hall, you know, Road to Perdition, this rainy night and everything, and you've got this long sort of Epping forest that seems to go on forever. Oh, is that a backdrop, or are you actually shooting into a forest there? And
no, we were actually I think there's like one or two shots that are composites, you know, like there's a close-up of Judd that we, you know, with the rain coming on him that we shot on a stage, but most of it was in the real forest there. And that one is another great example of, you know, Ryan knowing exactly what he wants, and it's really heightened and theatrical. And it's not just that he knows what he wants, like in prep. I mean, it's baked into the script, even, you know, the thing where it's really dark, and then the camera light comes on because there's the motion detection camera that has the light on. And it comes on, and it just, even though in the world of the movie it's not super bright, it feels like it's super bright because it's so dark out there and it's the brightest thing. And, you know, that, again, that was the kind of thing where this is so designed and confident by Ryan that, you know, like, again, in prep, we don't have to spend any time, like, you know, it's not like I'm pitching ideas to him and there's indecision and, you know, it's like, we already know this is what it is. But then he also trusts me to figure out how to do it, you know, so I've kind of got my work cut out for me where we can, you know, use the prep time to really, you know, for me and the gaffer Dave Smith to sit down and figure out how to make this thing the best it can be. So instead of sort of using the time to figure out what it even is, and then only at the end are you finessing it into the best it can be, we're actually using the whole time to finesse it into the best it can be because of Ryan being so clear and confident in what he's after.
Yeah. You've also got in that scene, I believe you got people with lanterns and stuff. And what have you got in that lantern? Is there like a sort of an aperture, sort of one of those discs or something, or what's in
there? It was different with different ones. Okay. Some of them we were just stuck with whatever the lantern really was.
Mm-hmm.
But some of them, Dave Smith's fixtures foreman was able to actually. I mean, none of the lanterns had movie lights in them, but there were some where he was able to take the off-the-shelf light out and put one in that was brighter and more of a color that we wanted.
You can't affect that at all. That's just how it is.
I
wondered if that was something that you could actually control with your...
Usually I could control... I can't remember. There might have been some that I could turn on and off from my system.
Gotcha.
I can't remember. But one thing that we could control that was fantastic, and you know, we've been doing this for a few years now, and you know because it's been a while now, you know, when I first started in cinema, you know, it was not normal, you know, it was, you know, smartphones weren't a thing,
no,
you know, and now it's so ubiquitous, so whenever you have a contemporary movie there's scenes with people holding phones and tablets and all of that. And I used to get really frustrated about like what the color and brightness coming off of it. And you know, there's very little control over it. I mean, the best you can do is try to, you know, go into the settings and change the, you know, you can change the overall brightness. And, you know, I mean, now like more recently there's things like, you know, like Apple has a night shift where you could go in and, but it's hard to, you know, it's still frustrating. So, you know, but now for a couple of years, with the system that we've got, we put all the phones and tablets on the system too. So I can actually, like, if somebody's holding a phone, I can actually change the brightness and color remotely from my station.
That's cool.
So, you know, so we can actually get it to, so we kind of started at a, you know, we might kind of start it at something real, like, okay, this is like sort of the normal white point of a screen. And then, you know, for example, if you're in a incandescently lit room that's warm colored, you might want the screen to be cool to get that sense of it's cool versus the warm, but that might be too much, right? Like the real coolness might be too much. You got to tone it down, or, you know, or, you know, a lot of these screens are going to be magenta. Like their sort of white point out of the box is going to be magenta compared to all of our lights. So if all of our lights look nice, it's going to look too magenta. Or if it looks right, all of our lights are going to look green. So it's easy to just dial the magenta out of it or whatever. And you know, and I'm not looking at the phone, I'm looking at the monitor where I can see exactly how it's actually coming out. And I've got it on like a, you know, like a gentle knob where I'm turning it in small increments.
That's really cool. And speaking of screens, there was another thing that I think you put it in your nose, it's certainly effective. We always have in these Benoit Blanc mysteries, there's always a moment where he's sitting by the fireside. I think it's one of those where I saw it in Knives Out. I saw it when he was obviously watching the Mona Lisa burn in Glass Onion. And then in this one, there's another one. You've got a way with doing those with screens and how they reflect in people's faces. Do you want to talk me through that one?
That's right, yeah. So that was another thing that we were doing with this system was we have some stuff where you can see fire and some other things reflected in people's eyes or eyeglasses. And so we had the lighting department actually had a few monitors, like, you know, so they weren't like the video monitors for viewing, they were actually lighting monitors. And from my system, I could send the image. And if it was a still image, I could actually send it wirelessly. If it was video, we did have to have a wire going from my system to the to the monitor for it to play back smoothly. So with the fire, we had shot fire at 200 frames a second to create this element where it's a little unreal because it's fire that's actually going crazy, but it feels roiling because it was shot at 200 frames. And so we play that back and we're using the shot footage to create the shape only. So it's basically luminance only. And then the color, I'm dialing it in. So I can dial the, you know, I mean, I can also adjust the overall luminance, but we're getting the shape, the luminance shape of the fire, like where is it bright versus where is it dark from the photography. And then I can change the overall luminance and I can change the actual color of it. Because if you were to use the color from the photography, that actually wouldn't be right for fire because firstly, it's color rendered instead of being the original fire. But more importantly, when you shoot fire, you know, a lot of it blows out and you get white stuff. So it's not actually fire color. You know, there's like sometimes it's only fire color at the edges and then the middle is white hot and it comes out white. So if you were to actually use the color from the photography, you'd be losing some of the warmth of it. So we just use the luminance from the, you know, or the contrast from the photography. And then we set the luminance and the chroma on set the same as we would with a movie light, except it's a monitor.
That's amazing. And it plays in people's faces and on the glasses as well.
Yeah. So we only did it when you could see it, you know, when it was farther back, we would just do it with regular movie light. I mean, I was still controlling it, but we wouldn't do it with a monitor. We would do it with regular movie lights because when you're farther back, you see that something's flickering in their eye, but you can't see the shape of it. Yeah. So when we were in really close, we would do it with the monitor so that you could see it reflected. You know, yeah. Like, you know, we also had a scene where, a shot of Vera in the church, in the denouement at the end. And there was like, I don't remember the details of what was going on, but there was this combination of where everybody was around her, where the windows were in the movie. So it's got to at least be lit from that side, even if it's not lit from exactly where the real window is. And then like, you know, her hair was kind of, you know, like, you know, we're kind of the, you know, she had a little bit of a hair tunnel where, you know, you can't light her from too far from the side. And on top of all of these other things that were going on, she had these big glasses on. Yeah. And so I just took an iPhone photo of It wasn't an iPhone photo. I just grabbed from one of the art department plans of the windows, and I just put that in my system so that I had one of the actual windows from the church. We put that on the monitor, and we lit her with the monitor so that you see the reflection of the church window in her glasses.
That's such a brilliant technique. And I can't believe other people have thought of it. It's great.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, I don't think it's that people haven't thought of it. I think that it's only now that there's a very quick, easy way to do it. Yeah. You know, it's not the idea of it. It's the, how do you actually achieve it? That's the, you know, like we did stuff like that on Knives Out, but not with monitors. We did it with arts and crafts where we would take the diffusion on the front of a light and put tape on it or something to make it the shape of the thing that was supposed to be reflected. Obviously, you couldn't do that with fire, but you could do that with a window.
Yeah.
You know, because a window's not moving. So, we you could have done that another way. But this one was faster and easier because we've already got the monitor. We already have the image of the window. I can just put it in the system and send that to the monitor.
Love that. Speaking of windows, actually, my final thing that I was going to ask, which was really cool, was the way that you shot the flashbacks. And it was like through this, we had this kind of like a red and blue stained glass, and then it was almost black and white flashback in the middle of it. You want to talk me through that? Because that was such a really cool technique. And
that was something that, that was just something Ryan came up with in prep. I don't remember what led him to it. I think we were showing him, I can't remember what it was. I think we were showing him some stuff that the art department had with the whatever, but it's just colored perspex, which is perspex or plexiglass, UK versus American name for it. But it's just regular, you know, not film industry stuff, just regular colored perspex. And, so we wanted to do this thing where, you know, it's covering parts of the frame. They're usually red and blue, but sometimes there's a green one or whatever. And it's kind of, the idea is it's flashback, kind of like you're looking through a stained glass window. And so for most of the flashback shots, and there's some of this same flashback, you kind of see it once where it's more through a narrator and once where it's more sort of what actually happened.
Yeah.
And it's the narrator ones that have this sort of unrealistic memory aspect to them. And then one thing that we did was there were a few shots where we couldn't have the perspex because it was like, it's a big wide shot and we're also dollying over or whatever. And so there are a couple of those shots where this actually wasn't planned. I came up with it when we were shooting them. I said to Ryan, what if I make it out the windows, I make it out there a totally unrealistic color that's instead of the perspex. So there's like one, there's one of the shots where out the window, it's this crazy blue color that's not a night blue. It's not any color that you would use for like nighttime blue out there. It just looks like a crazy primary blue. Yeah. And then there's another one where it's just completely red out the window. You know? So, and those were specifically flashback shots that didn't have the perspex in them, then had it in the rhyming colors brought in through the windows.
One of the things that also struck me with this film as well was like when with the camera movement, you're obviously having there's moments where Glenn Close is suddenly appearing behind somebody's back when she's introduced as characters. It's humorous as well, but it's one of those where I always wonder like how much you've talked about you and Ryan designing shots and stuff like that. Seems to be the thing that you do rather than looking at sort of references, you'll look more at shot design and how you're going to do it and stuff like that. So how long are you spending on that in terms of working on what there's one is working on a walkthrough of all the characters and stuff. There's one where they're all stood outside of Wix's mausoleum, I'll call it, or whatever you want to call it, his grave. And you move through all of the different characters. So we get introduced to all of them, see exactly who they are. Same thing happens, I think, when they're in the priest's house and stuff like that, we move around them all and stuff like that. So how long are you spending designing that and, you know, working out exactly where the camera's going to go to reveal this character and stuff like that, you know?
Yeah, I mean, depending on which one it is, some of those are, you know, Ryan always has a shot list and an exact plan. Mm-hmm. So some of them are literally that is the exact plan and we're just figuring out the best way to execute it. But some of them, although he does have a plan, it either has a little less precision or it's a little more malleable based on blocking, you know, in which case there's a little more figuring it out and, you know, figuring out not just how to do it, but exactly what does that plan look like now in more concrete as opposed to abstract? Okay,
yeah.
For the most part, the scenes that were most where his shot list is more of a abstract guide and we're figuring out the details tend to be the scenes where, you know, like in the rectory when you have eight people sitting in a circle and nobody's moving much, but you have a lot of characters and, you know, eight pages of dialogue or something like that. You know, those are ones where we tend to do it more, you know, again, not that he doesn't have a plan, but the turning the plan into a reality is much more where the exact shot specifics come in. Yeah. Whereas things that are more sort of like, action-based single person type stuff are going to be much more, this is exactly like he had such a literal thing and we're just figuring out the best, most powerful way to execute the thing. And there's no figuring out what that thing is. It's just figuring out the best way to execute it.
And are you blocking on the day, or is that like for things like that, or is that something that you've got super planned out in advance?
We always block on the day. So Ryan always comes in with an idea of what he wants the blocking to be. It's not like finding it from scratch. I mean, he always that's a huge, huge part of his planning. Yeah. But that doesn't mean that he's moving the actors around like puppets, you know. I mean, it's a very collaborative thing where he might say, you know, well, this is what I was thinking, let's see how it feels. And, you know, and, you know, usually, because the sort of the crux or important part of his shot design, you know, isn't, inflexible, you know, right. There's some sort of superficial details that don't matter to what's essential about it. Mm-hmm. So a lot of times, even if the blocking does change, a lot of times it doesn't change from what he was thinking. Mm-hmm. But even if it does change, or even just if there's some specifics that he hadn't anticipated, right? Like it might even be it didn't change, but there's mm-hmm. just some, now we're in the real world instead of a piece of paper, and there's just some specifics that weren't anticipated. That still doesn't usually change the shot, you know, because the shot already was flexible enough to accommodate these, you know, sort of what was specific and essential about it didn't include these superficial things that have now changed.
And presumably when you're shooting in Britain, there's enough challenges in itself, right? With all the changing weather patterns and everything like that, when you're shooting in Epping Forest, I don't imagine it's the easiest place to shoot.
we did have some stuff like that, but, you know, obviously there's a ton of interiors which are all on stage.
Yeah.
And then we have a lot of
nights. Did you shoot those over there, or did you shoot some over here?
It was all in London. The only stuff that was in the States at all was some like sort of second unit and additional photography, like of the town and stuff like that. But we had so much, you know, like so much of it was interiors where, you know, all the scenes where the interiors are very much interacting with the exterior, where you're mm-hmm. feeling that weather stuff. That's all us doing that on a studio, and we're making the weather. We're not waiting for it. And then we have obviously lots of night stuff where, you know, it's not going to go sunny to overcast. It doesn't mean anything at night. So obviously there is a bunch of day stuff, but it was limited. We did have some of those issues. You know, the scene where Samson's whitewashing the tomb, you know, there's actually, I mean, you can see it on cuts. It actually pops from sunny to overcast. And we just had to color correct it to kind of all be the same overall color balance and brightness. And hopefully it's not distracting, but, you know, all of the scenes that were much more, you know, that's not a big lighting scene, you know, but we have all these other scenes that are, you know, that really call for very specific evocative stuff. Like we have things that are supposed to be dusky that weren't shot at dusk and things like that. So a lot of that was done in conjunction with our first assistant director and the scheduling to make sure that, you know, if this, you know, because there, you know, there might be a long-ish, not super long, but long-ish scene that's supposed to be at dusk. And, even if we can do a shot at dusk, we can't shoot the whole scene at dusk. So when are we going to shoot this? You know, so we would schedule where, for example, when we are in the forest, we know at some point the sun hasn't set, but there's like at this specific spot where we're shooting, the trees are really thick there. And we know at what time, even if it's not overcast, we're not going to be getting sprayed with sunlight. And, yeah. You know, so a lot of it was the combo of scheduling. Gotcha. With him knowing those things, but then also being agile. Like if we thought something was going to happen and something changed, then we say, hey, can we flip these two scenes? Because now it's more important to do that one later in the day or whatever.
Yeah. It always feels like people go to Britain for Gothic nowadays. We've got Robert Eggers and Jerry Blaschke going to do Werewolf. You know what I mean? And I think that Frankenstein, Guillermo del Toro was shot in Glasgow. So it feels like Britain's the kind of the Gothic center right now. I mean, if you want to shoot some Gothic horror, then let's go to Britain, you know? Yeah. Steve, we're getting close to the end, obviously. One thing that I wanted to actually get back to, because I know you mentioned it, was the backdrops and the spectacle. So I want to definitely bring that in before we finish the interview.
Yeah.
We can talk about that now. But then I want to talk about your vision for the future after this and, like, you know, what you're going to be doing technically. So let's talk about the backdrop, first of all. So tell me, because you referenced it and I made note of it to make sure I didn't forget. These spectacular backdrops, please.
No, thank you. Yeah, no, this was so exciting to me. So I worked with the art department and especially the supervising art director, Dean Clegg, to kind of figure out all the logistics of this. But I really wanted these two stage backdrops where there's, you know, trees and then behind it a sky. And that way I could light them separately. So like, for example, if we're at night, I can turn the lights off on the trees so that they're silhouette and put like a deep blue on the sky. So it's silhouette trees against the deep blue. Or if it's, you know, or if it's just bright and sunny out, I can just blast all of it with light until it's almost blown out, like where you can just barely still see the texture. Or, you know, if it's overcast or dusk or something like that, I can front light the trees dim so that you can see them, but they feel murky, and then light the sky to where it's, not dim like night, but where it's thicker and more textured than the blazing hot day. So we could sort of do all of these different versions. And, Dean and the whole art department, I mean, they were very supportive already, but we shot an early test of it, like where they just did like a kind of a 20-foot thing of it instead of the whole stage. And then when they saw what it was, they're like, oh yeah, okay, this is really exciting.
It's cool.
And it was just such a like great way to do it, because it was so fun. We're just like all of the light on the faces and everything, I could dial in the exact look and feel out there, you know. And it was also just amazing to see the artistry of the scenic painter. Was this guy, Steve Mitchell, who's been doing it for a long time. And just to see the artistry is mind blowing. Like the sky that he painted, because you never really see just the sky, you see kind of the combo of the front and the back and it's out the window. But like when you're standing on the stage and you see it, it looks photo real. And it's not like a flat sky, it's perspective where it feels like the ceiling of clouds receding, you know, into the distance towards the horizon. And he just paints this stuff freehand. And we could give him notes, like he could paint it once and then you say, can you scale it up a little? And also, can you make it a little more contrasty? You know, I wanted it to be as contrasty as it could, because in the scenes where it's blown out, if I flood it with light, you won't even see that it's contrasty because it's almost blown out. And then in the darker scenes, I can bring that contrast back in. And he would just repaint the whole giant thing in like a couple days. You know, I don't remember how long it took him, but it was like ridiculously fast. And I just don't know how the guy does. And he did all of the backing. You know, we had backings in, you know, the rectory and the police station. And, he did all of that stuff. But the, you know, obviously kind of the star of the show was the big church set. So.
Inside the church, yeah. I mean, I suppose that during a time where LED panels are being used, you know, like the volume's being used pretty routinely now, you know what I mean? To have something that was hand-painted like that and going back, harking back to the old days, as we call the old days. You know what I mean? I suppose that was quite heartening, right?
Yeah, it was fantastic.
So, Steve, let's talk now, moving on to like yourself and looking beyond Wake Up Dead Man and everything. You know, sort of what technical or artistic aspects of cinematography are you currently exploring to sort of develop the genre further? I know that you're really focusing on all these different technical ideas, but talk me through and what are you looking at and, you know, that can help advance cinematography in general, really?
Yeah, I mean, the biggest thing I'm working on right now is the sort of light control product that I mentioned, which is still a little ways off, but we're hoping it's going to be closer. And it's really, it's kind of meant to be something instead of dimmer board console software, but it's not itself dimmer board. It's something that we're, cinema instead of concerts are the main idea of it. And also all of the contemporary stuff, such as high pixel density lighting and LED lights and other technologies where you can control the color. All of these things are built into the fabric of it, rather than the thing was built before those existed and now it's kind of been, plopped on top. It's kind of right at the core of it, and also for very complex, like timeline based queuing, and productions where there's tens or hundreds of thousands or even millions of control channels, and just all of these things in one, and really it's all born out of the fact that this is how I want to do it. but unlike some of my other personal tools, this one felt like something that could be good for a lot of people, not just my weird idiosyncrasies, because it really does feel like how it should be done. Another example of that is one of the things with this light control method is it can make dumb lights into smart lights. I mean, we have to have a data set on the lights. It can't just magically do it. But we have all these different brands of movie lights where you can control the exact chromaticity. Like you can give it not just a color temperature, but you can give it an exact, color science chromaticity. That's cool. And it'll make that light. So a lot of the movie lights already do that. But a lot of times we're not using movie lights. We're using like generic LED ribbon. Yeah. Or something which doesn't have, not only does it not have that color engine in it, it doesn't have any color engine in it. The controller literally just, if it's got red, green, blue, and five whites, you can just turn them up and down separately.
Yeah.
So this is a way to, turn those into where it's interchangeable. You could use those cheap LED ribbon interchangeably with the fancy movie light and still get the exact same color that you want.
That's cool.
And the best blend of that color that's got the broadest spectrum and the brightest white. Yeah. And we actually use that on Wake Up Dead Man because, in that main church set, the whole ceiling of it had like soft boxes covering the entire ceiling. And that set had to be standing from the beginning of production to the end because of actors' schedules and some other reasons. It's not like it was just at the beginning and then we're tearing it down. And what that allowed us to do was to build those soft boxes out of cheap LED ribbon, but still have the full, not just luminance control, but color control. And then that way we're not renting movie lights that are sitting there for, weeks upon weeks, which would be incredibly expensive, but we still have the full control over it. Which, in the recent past, obviously in the distant past, this stuff didn't even exist. But in the recent past, what probably would have happened almost certainly would have happened is they would have used bicolor ribbon instead of the full color control ribbon, just because there's no good color control method.
Mm-hmm.
And then you would be stuck with bicolor. You're just stuck on a crossfade between warm and cool. You can't make any precise color that you want, like dialing in green versus magenta and all of that. So this gave us the absolute full color control and not having to rent the movie lights, and also makes them lighter soft boxes because it's just got ribbon in it instead of big heavy movie lights.
I bet production loved you as well. You didn't have to, pull them for those orchard in lights. Yeah. Steve, I always try and do this because obviously a lot of our audience is upcoming young DPs and a lot of people from like AFI and things like that, film students who are wanting to learn about cinematography or or certainly wanting to hone the craft of cinematography. You as an established DP who's made some of the most, you know, wonderful films and captured some of the wonderful images. I mean, honestly, that I have to say before we go, the Throne Moon scene from Last Jedi is one of my favorites in all of cinema. I wanted to on my wall, but I am going to get played. You're losing out to Jaws right now. But yeah, so as this established DP and as somebody who's made some wonderful images, what piece of advice would you give to upcoming DPs in this new age? We've got streaming, we've got all these new techs that are all coming out and things like that. What's your advice to them? I know it's putting you on the spot.
Yeah, no, I mean, you know, obviously, I mean, I'm mostly just really lucky because I met Ryan when I was 17 or 18 years old. So that's not something you can plan. But I mean, the thing I will say is I think just keeping the love and curiosity of cinema and bringing yourself to it. What do you love? You know, because I think sometimes when people are trying to get going and there's that frustration of it's not happening, is there's almost this sort of wanting to sell out when nobody's asking you to. Like, how can I make myself exactly what people want? And the problem is that you know, that's just making you interchangeable. You know, I mean, you know, if you're kind of true to what makes you passionate about it, even if that's idiosyncratic and weird, that is your selling point. Because you know if you're trying to have a job that is you know, creative and unique, there does need to be something specific about you that's not an interchangeable cog. So just staying true to your vision and passion for what gets you excited about cinema.
I really like that. That's a really cool one. And I suppose I'm going on to other, that should have been a closing question, but I'm intrigued as to what your opinion is on AI, since you're such a person who's involved in technology and technological advancement and stuff like that. Is AI something that's scary to you, or is it something that we should harness, you know, as creatives and see how it can be used? Because I know that right now, I mean, so I've got friends who are working at the AFI right now. They're actually being proposition by studios to see how AI can be used in the creative pipeline. It's something that a lot of people are quite scared about, the frightened of talking about. What about yourself? What's your thought process on it?
I really don't know. I think anybody that's confidently prognosticating is full of hot air. So I really don't know. I mean, the one thing I will say is AI is very much a buzzword. And if we're talking about specifically large language model, which is the type of AI that's that people are usually talking about, I don't think it's accelerating the way people think it is. I mean, it's basically a fuzzy search engine. You know, it's a blurry lookup, basically. And so people think it's amazing when you ask it to do a mashup. You're like, oh my God, look how incredible this is. And you're like, yeah, because it's a mashup machine. Of course it can do a mashup, you know? I think it's kind of a thing where it accelerated so fast and, you know, people tend to project future things on a linear scale, but it's never, there's always an S curve with anything that's sort of, and I feel like it's going to accelerate and taper off. And this version of it, I can't see being much more than it is of a fuzzy lookup that helps with certain things and hinders other things. And it's just a lookup tool, really, you know, to an extent. Now, other kinds of AI and machine learning that aren't large language model, I have no idea. But in terms of this specific thing, again, I'm not confidently prognosticating, but I'm saying I feel like it's just going to continue to be what it is, which is a mashup machine. And in some ways, not only is it not going to get better, it's going to get worse, because as it continues to be a mashup of existing stuff, when it started, there wasn't any AI generated things for it to mash up. Now it's a feedback loop where in the world is AI stuff for it to mash up too, which is really going to slow it down. So I don't know, but it fascinates
me just purely because you know, like there's people I know right now, Lionsgate have got like, I don't know, a group of people who are working on putting their whole catalog into this sort of AI runway, whatever you want to call it, you know, and using it to generate things like storyboards, they've said to me, like they're using it to generate. And I was like, well, surely that's part of the creative process. Surely that's like, you know, yourself and Ryan sitting down and designing a storyboard, or designing, you know, sitting with a storyboard artist and talking through the shots and the moves that you want to do. And that's something that's kind of, it's a bit freaky really in that respect. You know, I don't know if Netflix is planned on doing anything of the same kind of ilk, but one of the things that I'm actually quite enjoying about Netflix right now, and it's something that I'm hoping that you guys are going to do for Wake Up Dead Man, they did a wonderful thing with Guillermo del Toro on Frankenstein, where him and Dan Lausten talked about color, you know, the color that they were using and the different, you know, ways in which they used shots and the way that, and it's brilliant. It's kind of like having the old DVDs with a VTS.
Oh, like, the DVD extras, yeah.
It felt like that. And I wonder if they're going to do that for Wake Up Dead Man, because it is something that's actually drawing me back to Netflix, I suppose. Right? Wow. I can watch a film and watch the making of, you know.
Wow. I don't know if they are, but I want to watch that Frankenstein one because that's a beautiful movie. So
it's phenomenal. It's brilliant.
So it's on, I'm going to watch this. It's on Netflix. But how do you turn on the commentary though?
There's a different video.
It's a different movie.
What was it? The Dark Knight, where Nolan does a shot by shot, how we did each shot, but it's sort of like a 45-minute.
Okay, it's not a director's commentary. It's a separate movie.
Sadly, no. And I wish there was a director's commentary because I missed those.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'd give it a watch because it's 45 minutes and he talks about how it, you know, how the color starts off black, white, and red, and then how it develops and stuff like that. It's really, really cleverly done.
I'm gonna watch it. That sounds awesome. That movie is just mind-blowingly beautiful.
Yeah, and if you've got any sway at Netflix, you should definitely definitely do one for this film. Because
yes, I don't know if I can cause that to happen. Ryan might be able to, but I certainly can't. So.
Honestly, Steve, it's been such a pleasure talking to you, and you've given us so many things. I mean, inevitably, this is going to get chopped down into certain sound bites and things like that. But I really hope that people get a chance to listen to this whole thing, because yeah, you can tell that your passion for this genre is fantastic, and honestly I really look forward to everything you do. As I said, I've been a fan since Looper. I went back and saw Brick after seeing Looper, and then the rest of the ones I've seen since, so I'm a real big fan. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. What a pleasure. Thank you.
You know, I've been on enough sets to know that the best learning happens in the moment. When you start to see the blocking happen and you start to visualize the light. That's why the Filmmakers Academy app is a total game changer. Need to brush up on your camera settings, maybe some lighting setups, or some team dynamics to build and inspire? Pull out your mobile device, open the app, and boom, pro-level guidance at your fingertips. Download the Filmmakers Academy app and bring the knowledge with you to every set, every shoot, every time.